lane. It's one lane, very narrow. And to get there, you have to go down at an angle like this. Now, when you're pulling one of these things with a truck, that ain't no fun, okay? Because the trailer isn't getting to the down part until after. So you do this number. Oh, that was fun. Anyways, I'm here. It's working. I haven't knocked anything off of it yet. So we're excited about that. And I am joined by Dr. Jason Lyle of the Biblical Science Institute, who happens to live in these parts as well. And we have had Jason on the program a number of times. You've been on Sheologians. That makes you even more famous than being on The Dividing Line. Summer will bake me something for having said that. I imagine some brownies or something eventually. Gluten-free, probably. But so we've had you on the program, but we've never been able to do anything in person. Now, we have done things in person. In fact, I've told the story that the primary reason I have to have a storage room is so I can have a cool place to store my telescopes. Mm-hmm. And you do realize that's completely your fault.
You do
realize that. We've told the story before. We were in Dallas with Amelia Ramos. Mm-hmm. And we were doing a bunch of Christian worldview stuff. I think you were doing... Did you do your presuppositional thing at that one? I can't remember these things either. But
we had a Q&A, I remember that.
We had a Q&A, and I was underdressed. You all were making me look bad. And we got done about, I don't know, 4 something in the afternoon. And all of a sudden you said, hey, want to do some stargazing? Now, it's been a long day. We had spoken the night before, and I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, all right. So we went over to somebody's house, and you drove your car sort of on an embankment behind somebody's fence. In fact, didn't the cops come along and make you move your car eventually?
They did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's the first time that it ever happened?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, so I was with Dr. Jason Lyle when he started down the road toward whatever it is he's headed towards. So, but you set up, yours is a 16-inch?
14-inch.
14-inch Dobsonian. And now I've got to tell you, folks, I hope I'm not revealing secrets here, but I had never seen one of these things before. And I was very impressed with its go-to function, where you could tell it to go here and it turns there and things like that. But you really, you know when you really impressed me was about 2 years ago when you drove up to Evergreen. And you brought the same telescope. I had my 8-inch Meade. It's a nice scope. Mm-hmm. But something went wonky with the motor on your telescope. Didn't slow them down. It was just a mess. Okay, so it's like it moved there on its own. I know where it's supposed to be pointing. So it's just like, okay, I think it's about right there. And I'm just sort of like, okay, yeah, all right. So that first night, you showed us. You obviously had a priority list of start with stuff and then move to the cool stuff.
Yeah.
I figured that out. I figured that out later on. Yeah, and so we're looking at Jupiter. Both Jupiter and Saturn were visible that night, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And this guy's sitting here going, "Okay, this is this moon, and that's some of the characteristics of that moon, and this is that moon," and I'm sitting here going, what? And with a 14-inch, you can get some resolution regarding the bands on Jupiter and stuff like that quite easily, and even the rings on Saturn. Mm-hmm. You kept Saturn toward the end.
Of course, yeah. That's the highlight.
But that wasn't the last thing you showed us. Hmm. This is, maybe you didn't know this, but this is what got me, is you showed us Alberio. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was getting tired. I really was. And then you said, I think you all would really like seeing Alberio. Oh, okay, fine. Now, actually, I had asked to see Andromeda. I really wanted to see. Go ahead and kill him.
Yeah.
Go ahead. If you can get him faster than I can, that's great. So you showed us Andromeda, and that blew me away. I'm sitting here going, and you're talking about how fast we're heading toward it and all the rest of this fun stuff. And but then afterwards, the last thing we looked at was Alberio. Mm-hmm. And I've of course sent you. I sent you. Notice what the background of my
Alberio.
is my shot of Alberio.
Yeah.
I mean, I took that shot. And if you've never seen Alberio, if you live like in a massively light polluted city, I feel for you. Okay, my heart goes out to you. You have missed some of the most beautiful stuff of God's creation. And, you know, I can't tell you how many Christians I talk to. And they just sort of look at me like, oh, that's up in the sky, huh? You know, and it's just, and it, I don't know how to communicate to somebody.
Yeah.
To say.
You kind of have to see it.
You have to see it. And you have to see it in something other than a picture or something on a computer.
There's something about seeing it with your own eyes.
I know. Yeah. Even though you're looking through an instrument, it's still, because through a telescope, you still have to, there's that working of your eye you have to do to get that right focus and stuff like that. It's mm-hmm. hard to explain how to do it. You tried to explain it to us, but it's still something you've just got to do on your own.
Yeah.
But still, once you see it, you've done this far more times than I have. But I've given a couple star shows for some church groups, and I love, like, when you do oh, good grief, Nebula, Orion's Nebula.
Oh, yeah.
And especially if you've got a filter in that makes the color pop.
Mm-hmm.
And someone walks up that's sort of been a little, for the evening, and all of a sudden they look through that, and they back up with their eyes. What is that? That's been staring at you your whole life. I love the reaction you get out of it. And kids are either just immediately taken or they want to go play their video games.
Right.
One of the two. There's almost no in between. it's amazing.
Yeah.
But there we were out along some road, and it really wasn't the darkest sky area.
No, it wasn't.
But you could still see some deep sky objects. And so when I got back, I said, all right, I'm going to get a 6-inch. It's not motorized, but it does have the computer on it so that it knows where you're moving it type thing. So it is a go-to. It's just not motorized. And they're not all that expensive. And if I use it and I stick with it, then I can get a bigger scope. And so I did. And so just last, when was that conjunction with Saturn and Jupiter recently?
Oh, that was just last December 21st.
Okay, there was a Christmas party at our church at a fellow who's pretty well off. And so you'll be so proud of this, sitting in front of this person's house, I had my 8-inch Mead and I had the 6-inch set up so that everybody could watch the conjunction and see the conjunction. And that's made a lot of them go, but I can still tell the difference between the two. I said, they weren't actually right on top of each other.
You don't realize. That's the first time in human history since we've had telescopes that we've been that close.
Right.
So, man, and that's not going to happen again for 60 years. So,
yeah, I think you and I are pretty much out of it.
I think so, yeah. I hope to not be alive.
Well, if you are, hopefully you can still see, because that'd be a bummer to not be able to see that. So, anyway, so getting into all that stuff was all this guy's fault, and he will take the blame for it, whether he wants it or not. But it's been great, and it's not looking good for us to get to do much.
It's been looking better. We might.
You never know.
There's smoke.
Oh, the haze. Yeah, yeah. Wow, I could barely even see the mountains.
Yeah.
When I was coming in, it was like, where'd the mountains go? This is Colorado, and there's no mountains around. Anyway, we're going to actually be speaking tomorrow, starting
4 o'clock, I think, is when the event begins.
Yeah. Okay, and we're both speaking twice.
No, you're speaking twice. I'm speaking once.
You sure about that?
I'm sure about that.
Oh, okay. All right.
I prepared one talk. So
oh, all right. I thought we were both speaking twice, but okay. All right. So they're making me do more of the work. That's
as it should be.
Make the visitor do the work. Okay, I get it. Anyways, I don't have the stuff in front of me. Do you have where people can go or
It was in Hope Chapel. That's my home church. And you can look it up, Hope Chapel, Colorado Springs. Look it up on the website. That'll get you all the information.
Yeah. And starting. Well, I'll just ask him to speak up a little bit, but no, because the microphone is the computer. So, all right. Okay. Well, you know me. I yell. And he's much more. Scholars don't yell. Not as much as Rich would like them to. So, anyway, so we'll be speaking tomorrow evening, and anybody in the Colorado Springs area, you're more than welcome. And then I'm going to be heading up to Denver, and I will be preaching at Redemption Hills Church on Sunday morning and Boulder Bible Church Sunday evening, for those of you who want to are in that particular area. And really, if you live sort of between the two, you could go to all of them if you wanted to. It's not that far of a drive. But we're up here in Colorado for a while. I'm on my way next week up to Idaho, where I will speak so many times between Thursday and Monday morning that I can't even remember all of them. But that's just how it goes when you're up there. I'll also be speaking, I'll be stopping in Frenchtown, Montana or Wyoming. Sorry. Montana. It's on the website. We have a wonderful calendar there with the address and everything else. And then I'll be speaking in Las Vegas, Nevada on the way back home, assuming that I have not gone through a excessively low bridge and taken the top of this off or something like that on the way. I'm learning. I am really learning a lot. Now, speaking of learning, there is a book to your left there that had a fly sitting on it just now, that I showed everybody on the dividing line, and it's got your name on the front, but I'm probably one of the only people who ever suggested to you about writing a book about that subject as someone who, I mean, I've been doing fractal art since computer programs started coming out that allowed you to do fractal art. And the Mandelbrot set and the Julia fractals and all this kind of stuff. I would post this kind of stuff and people would sort of go, that sort of looks like you came from the 1960s and never escaped. It's like you're wearing a tie-dye shirt type thing, you know. And it's like, no, there's a whole lot more to it than this. But I remember the first time I suggested to it, you said, yeah, well, I'm already going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you had, when you did your presentation, and you did one presentation where you had some technical issues, and then you did one later on that I think you sort of replaced the first one with that one. When did the book idea, was that first or second?
Well, I've always been interested in fractals. I learned about them. I was in high school when I learned about them. I read a book by Roger Penrose, the mathematician, called The Emperor's New Mind, which in itself would be worthy of discussion. It's a fascinating read. He's exploring the nature of consciousness from his apparently non-Christian perspective.
Interesting.
And he discusses different things in nature. Could this be the source of consciousness? And basically, no, nothing in nature can be the source
right,
of consciousness.
Right, right.
And one of the things he discusses is chaos. Can chaos be the source? And he talks about fractals and the Mandelbrot set in particular. I thought, that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And back then I had just a low-end PC. It was like an 802.86.
Yeah, 286,
yeah.
Man.
Woohoo! Yeah. And so I wrote a little computer program to plot the Mandelbrot set. And I was amazed by it. And, you know, especially as I zoom in on some of these sections and see the incredible beauty of it. And back then it took, of course, I wrote it in BASIC. I wasn't a real good programmer back then. I've gotten a little better over the years. But I wrote a program to do it. And some of these plots, it would take over 24 hours for them to render. And then I would print them out because then that's it. There was no way
to save it and keep it.
And that was back in the time, you know, this was before the internet. So obviously this was back in a time where you couldn't just download somebody else's program. There were BBS systems and I didn't have access to those.
Oh, goodness. You were a BBS guy too.
Yeah.
I was on the Mormon Echo, Bible Echo. I was doing the theological stuff. Okay. You were out geeking out on math stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And there were some VBS systems, but generally back in those days, if you wanted the program to do something, you had to write it. So I wrote my own, and it was inefficient, but it got the job done. And lately, I've been able to speed things up. I've learned better computer languages, C#, things like that, or the new programs in C#. It's fast. It's optimized for the Malebranche set. But I've always thought they were fascinating.
Always. Everyone that I've ever directed to your presentation on it has just been blown away by it. They really found it to be fascinating, even though I think some folks are like, cool, but I'm really not sure what I just saw, you know. But the mathematically minded are pretty blown away by it. Now, for me, look, all the color stuff is just simply assigning values to numbers and stuff like that. But I have always been absolutely fascinated with color. I mean, if you're familiar with the Impressionist painter Claude Monet, Monet is just one of my favorites because the color that he was able to produce. And some of his, when you zoom in on some of his paintings, it's like, oh, that looks like my fractal art. It really, really does. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not so much the math part as I am the output, you know, what you end up seeing. But still, that chaos stuff, remember Jurassic Park, the discussion of chaos at that time. And of course, the illustration that it's true. The direction a butterfly taking off from a branch in Colorado can literally impact where a hurricane strikes in Florida.
Yeah.
And it's true.
Yeah.
And the only way to explain it is through fractal mathematics and the just the hyper complexity that is found there. But it's fascinating because when you think about it, you see it now, but no one before the, 1980s?
Right.
Had any possible way of even knowing.
Right.
And so I sort of sit back and go, so why would the Lord create something like this? You've had the same thought.
Mm-hmm.
Why would the Lord create something like this that won't be known until this time in history?
Mm.
And as an apologist, part of my thinking is, we also, you know, Darwin didn't understand cellular biology, didn't understand DNA. DNA, and everybody knows what RNA is, mRNA is, for reasons that we won't get into right now, but those things, again, just the level of complexity of life unknown until this period in human history, where you have both the greatest opportunities for the demonstration of truth as well as the greatest opportunities to attack truth. And I sort of wonder if, and I'm speculating, I'm just trying to apply a biblical worldview, but I just sort of wonder if our knowledge of these things, we didn't even know. 100 years ago, they were still arguing about the puffy things in the sky. What in the world are these things? And now we know that they are galaxies as large as our own.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, thanks to Hubble, who was resurrected a couple of weeks ago, as you know. You heard about that, right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
As I figured you would.
They were to get it to work again.
So yes. Yeah. Yes. It was brought back to life. And we need it because the new one isn't supposed to be launched till later this year.
I'm not sure. They keep pushing it back. The James Webb Telescope.
Yeah.
They keep pushing it back and it's not serviceable. So once because Hubble's in Earth orbit.
Right.
So you can swap out components.
Right.
It's like 80% new telescope.
Right. Point. Right. Cause it was launched late 80s,
early 90s, something
yeah,
like that.
With,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
With the incorrect lens, they had to put CoStar. All the new instruments are built toward the new mirror.
Right, right.
Curvature. But yeah, the James Webb Space Telescope is not in Earth orbit. It'll be put out at the Earth, I think it's the L2 Lagrangian point out beyond Earth. It's not serviceable. Once it goes up, that's it. So pray everything works on the James Webb.
Oh, yeah. I did not know that. Is that so that it has a wider field of view or farther away from? Why would they put it? Why do that? What's the advantage?
Well, you don't have the rapid motion around the Earth, so there's that. It does get you beyond things like the moon, things like that. I'm not sure. If I had made the call, it would be in low Earth orbit like the Hubble is. In fact, that was, I remember them discussing that one time at the university when I was up at Boulder, and they were saying, yeah, the Hubble, you know, it's neat because it's serviceable. You can go and you can swap out instruments and the James Webb, but it can't do that. So let's pray it works, and it's not upgradable.
Yikes. Wow.
But it's a fine instrument, and I expect we'll see some of the data from it. But I'm glad the Hubble's still going because the Webb isn't quite a replacement of Hubble. I think it's infrared. So we're not going to get quite the same images. I like the Hubble, that the Hubble can do visual stuff.
Right.
Stuff that would look, you know, if I was there, that's what it would look like.
Right.
So that's kind of a neat thing about the Hubble. One of many things.
So the Webb is just...
I think it's infrared.
X-ray?
I think it's infrared.
Only infrared?
Yeah.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, all this stuff, you know, we now have... I have apps on my phone where and I bet you have the exact same apps and probably more, where you can pull down all these different current images of the sun. My solar telescope is finally has a use because I bought it right as the minimum was starting. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, sure, it's going to look like it did yesterday. There's nothing up there. But now there's a whole lot more to be looking at as far as sunspots and stuff goes. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mentioned this because, Dr. Lyle, your doctoral work was primarily on solar physics and regards to that. And, of course, you've then extended that out to looking at stars in general and especially star controversial stuff regarding star formation. There's a lot of assumptions that are functioning in science regarding blue stars or new stars and... So this is an area of star formation, and it's all based on a theory of the age of the universe. And so you find yourself, obviously, not exactly in the center of being loved.
Yeah, sure enough. You know, when it comes to stuff, you know, how stuff works today, you know, the scientific method, I'm all for it. And a lot of the stuff we've learned about stars, it's great information. But when they start speculating about the distant past, you've left the realm of science at that point. And they're every day it seems like we've discovered new data.
But they don't seem to make that distinction.
No, they don't. They don't.
Are they just not taught to make that distinction?
I think that's a big part of it. I wasn't in my secular education. I was not taught to make that distinction. And I think it's an important one because your worldview assumptions they're always important, but they're far more important when you're speculating on the past.
Right.
Far more important.
Right.
And
because if you're wrong here, gets wrong, wronger and wronger and wronger.
Yeah.
You go along, basically.
Like chaos, a little change here.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. And even with the star formation thing, just a couple of days ago, I read a new a paper that's published that said this challenges our star formation theories. And it had to do with the fact that a lot of these extrasolar planets that we're finding that orbit around their star, sometimes the star rotates this way and the planet orbits that way. And that's something that I would expect as a biblical creationist, because God can make all kinds of stuff. Because he's done that in our solar system. Some moons, like Triton, it goes the other way. Or they're, you know, like that. And so I would expect that. But that's totally contrary to the secular model where
you only have naturalistic forces working to form these things.
If everything collapsed from a nebula, conservation of angular momentum would keep everything spinning the same way. So all the planets and the star would be rotating about the same way. And for our solar system, not too far off, but it's a little bit off even with our solar. The sun's tilted 7 degrees relative to the planets. Mm. So how does that happen? There's not really any good explanation for that. And so now that we're finding other planets that, in my view, that's the diversity that the Lord's built into his universe. That's what I would expect, but it's contrary to secular expectations. We find stuff like that all the time.
And yet that becomes so central to the theoretical applications and purposes of what you're doing. I mean, worldview is just, and yet that just is not, the Western education, as it's being done today, especially if you're to do a specialization, I mean, you could, with the data that's available today, you could so narrowly specialize in something about the sun that could literally leave you ignorant about other aspects of the sun because it's so in-depth in this one area. And so because of that, then connecting what's there to the entirety of a worldview issue, our universities are a mess.
And I'm something of an exception because I like all the different branches of science, and I read all about them, and even in astronomy. And so even though I have my specialty field, I've read about other fields. Most scientists don't do that.
Yeah,
most scientists specialize in one field, and they could care less about it, which amazes me. Well, they have to get published. Well, that's true.
They're running the rat race of academia, and there are some real problems with that. There are real problems with that in science. There's real problems with that in theology. Because if you have to get published and you got to come up with something new, well, truth doesn't change all that much. And so it can be a real problem in theology as well. But yeah, not having, I have just, when I listen to scientists, they have bought into scientism and they don't even realize it. They don't even see. It's sort of like talking to a Jehovah's Witness that's never known anything other than what the Jehovah's Witnesses. Jehovah's Witnesses think that nobody out there even knows, for example, what Jehovah's name is. And so when they run across someone who knows what the Tetragrammaton is and knows what it is in Hebrew, there's, oh, I just didn't know. It's the same kind of glassy-eyed look that I get when I talk with some secularists. Because the next generation, we are finally getting into generations of people where they are completely secular. Their parents were secular.
Yeah.
There's no impact anymore. And so all of a sudden, you start challenging some of their worldview stuff, and they're just like, what planet did you come from? And why is it spinning backwards,
right.
Basically?
Right.
And the best they can do is, it's sort of like Jehovah's Witnesses will respond to a challenge by saying, you're attacking Jehovah's organization. And if you challenge the secularist, you're attacking science. You're anti-science.
Yes.
And it's like, no, science exists in something a lot bigger than just science. And they don't even know what to say.
There's an ignorance of the history of science, the fact that it stemmed from a Christian worldview.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, that I feel very blessed to live in the time that I live in, where we have things like these amazing shapes that you can now, on your own computer, you can explore this universe that's been there since creation, but we didn't know about it until 1980s.
Yep.
What a blessing. But that comes from Christian thinking. And I would argue that the Renaissance, all these things stem from a Christian worldview. Because of the expectation that nature is logical and orderly because it's upheld by the mind of God. And even folks like Newton, well, he may have been unorthodox on some issues, but at least, you know, he had respect for the Bible and he believed in a God who was orderly and upheld creation in a consistent way. And he was able to make more discoveries than any human being has a right to. He was truly brilliant. But or Kepler. Now, Kepler was a very consistent biblical Christian,
right,
and
right.
Really solid guy.
Oh, there are many of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was common.
It's common.
That was back then. If you're a scientist, well, of course you're a Christian.
But most of the textbooks don't even go there now, except out of embarrassment.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't. They don't see that there's any connection.
Right.
There's no connection whatsoever. And you know, when people have not been taught. To think from a worldview perspective and to see connections, they are easily controlled, and they are easily deceived. And man, are we seeing that in our world right now.
Yeah.
And part of me goes, oh, that's terrible, that's horrible, and I'm depressed. And then part of me goes, but the only reason you see that is because the Spirit of God has worked in your life so as to cause you to want to know truth and to be obedient to truth and to see these connections, and the Spirit hasn't gone anywhere. And Nancy Pelosi cannot ban the Spirit of God from the United States, even though I'm sure she'd like to. And so, I think it's my... Scotsmen tend to be a little bit on the dreary side at times. So, I mean, Scotty got depressed a few times on the Enterprise.
He did. Yeah.
He tended to...
That's why he drank a lot.
What's that? It's green. All right. No one's going to say what we just said, but I thought about it. Folks, I'm going to tell you something. I have a friend, and he's probably watching right now. His name's Ken Gontars. And Ken is watching the original Star Trek series. I don't know what channel it is, but it's on Saturday nights, and he would tell me, oh, this one's titled such and so. And I'd say, oh, that's about this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I realized, because I have all of them on this computer right here, all of a sudden I realized they were playing them in the order in which they were produced.
Mm-hmm.
Just straight down the line, which is the way they are in my program, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I start telling him, like, for example, The Trouble with Tribbles was recently. I said, okay, you've got one of the classics coming up. If you enjoy the comedic aspect of Star Trek, once this is done, you've got to go watch the DS9.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness, that was so good.
It was.
Oh, they did. I could watch that all day long. It was so, so well done. But so I'm telling him all this stuff. Well, the last episode that they played had a scene in it, and I've been telling him, I'll say, well, watch for this. Okay, this is the part you might find interesting. Or be careful, like the Gamesters of Triskelion. I said, you might not want to have the kids around on that one, because they were pushing the limits on that one at that point in the 1960s. But so there was this scene, and there was a line in it that just made me laugh. And so I was watching it, and so I said to Ken, watch for this line. And so Jason and I were texting about getting together today. And I decided to test this guy, because I've always said he's the smartest guy I've ever met, IQ off the charts, all the rest of the stuff. Well, we're talking about astrophysics, okay, and fractals and mathematics and Einstein and the speed of light stuff, which I still can't understand. We're not talking Star Trek here, okay? And so I go, all right, I'm going to test you. And I'm going to give you a line and tell me where it's from Star Trek. And it's, what is it? It's green. Now, I didn't even go green because I was texting. If I had said green, that would have actually totally given it one. And it was from Scotty. I won't tell the whole story. I don't know how many years ago this thing was produced, but Scotty decided to try to get this one alien, incapacitate this one alien with alcohol, basically. And so at one point he's pouring this guy, and the guy goes, what is it? And Scotty goes, it's green. And so I threw it out. And what did you say? Pshaw or something?
Please.
Please! And immediately named the episode. Like, come on! You would even ask me a question? I am insulted! And then makes me feel really bad when he goes, and remember, it was in Relics in the Next Generation. I'm like, what? What? And he had to tell me, and I had to go look, and Scotty had that was the only time he showed up in the Next Generation. Scotty, and that was, you gotta admit, somebody had to put some real hard work into figuring out how in the world do you get Scott. My daughter just said, this is the nerdiest thing I've ever watched on the internet. But how do you get Scotty into the Next Generation 75 years after he's supposed to be dead?
Mm-hmm.
And a transporter loop in diagnostic mode. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, someone stayed up late at night to come up with that one. So anyways, but it wasn't Scotty that did it. It was Data, which I found fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, the Data was the one that went, it's green.
It is green.
It is green, because he wouldn't use the contraction. That'd be lore. Okay, we lost it. No, there is nobody watching anymore. They were really enjoying the Christian worldview stuff, and then we went off after Star Trek.
In fairness, by any other Rose, by any other name, that is one of my favorite episodes of the original series. I like that one, and it terrified me too when they could turn the people into these
little tubes, and then go, they're toast.
Yeah.
And there you are. But they could bring you back as long as you didn't break the cube.
Right.
Then you're good. So, and then of course the energy barrier.
Yeah. At the perimeter of the galaxy,
which
for which there is no,
there is no such thing. But yeah, but it made for a fun. It made for fun with Scotty sitting there. Can we blow the Enterprise up now? Because that's what they were going to do. But they didn't do it. So, anyways, you would do that for Invaders?
No.
Well, we would for friends. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I guess suppose we should point out that we are aware of the fact that Star Trek was not a Christian program.
No, it was not.
But it is interesting, I'll be honest with you, to compare some of the worst of The Next Generation. There was, I recorded all The Next Generation on videotape, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so it had all the commercials in it and the whole nine yards. even Rich is going, oh, come on, guys. But there were one or two that I simply deleted.
There was the one with the androgynous people.
There was a really anti-theistic one.
Yes. Well, yeah, that was Who Watches the Watchers. That was the one where
Riker says
they're starting to believe in a god. And I'm like, oh.
Right. Something like that. Yeah, there were a couple I just deleted. But then there were some in the original, like the Roman one.
Yes.
Where Uhura at the end, no, they don't mean the sun is
the
sky.
They mean the
son of God. Yeah. And you're just like, how did... For us today, how did that get in there?
Mm-hmm.
But it was the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. It was. Things have changed. They've changed a whole lot, sadly. So there was a lot of secularism, and it got a whole lot worse in the Next Generation. There's no two ways about it. But it does illustrate how scientism can become a consuming worldview. And it seems to be not just amongst the people who study science, but in our society, that's the religion that we are being told we must bow the knee to now.
Yeah.
Is man's capacity to examine the universe outside of any worldview issue in pure neutrality, as if there is such a thing.
Hmm.
And you start there, and it's frightening what you can end up coming to as far as what you can do to your fellow man, worth of life. I look at the past 18 months, and I go, this hasn't been a lot of fun. A lot of people's businesses have been crushed. I don't know if anyone's going to do any studies, but I think the number of churches is going to decline a great deal. I think many churches that are still not meeting or meeting online, if they ever get back to, I think there's going to be an epsilon variant and a zeta variant and all the way. There's always going to be a new variant because that's what respiratory viruses are all about. It's always been that way. And we've never gotten rid of a respiratory virus, the vaccine.
Right.
It's impossible. It can't be done. But everyone's accepted that that's what we need to do, and therefore they're willing to do anything to get to an impossible goal. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, if we ever did get back to where I think a lot of those churches, the stories I'm hearing right now is when they start coming back, about a third of the people return.
Yeah.
Two-thirds have just gotten used to, oh, it's sort of fun just to have it on in the background on a Sunday morning for a while, and then I can get to go do what I want. And now, theologically, I stand back and go, that's not really a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because American evangelicalism has been filled with a whole lot of worldly driftwood to begin with. I get that. But we look at all these things, and I sit back, and I try to stand back and go, all right, what can the Lord bring out of all of this? And frequently we just can't see. But what can the Lord bring out of all of this? And being Scottish, I tend to go, well, it could get really bad. Okay, I mean, that's sort of the Scottish part of me coming through. And literally, as you know, that caused me to think through my eschatology and go, all right, what if, see, I'm a church historian. I've taught first class I ever taught when I graduated seminary was church history. I've taught it, teaching it right now for a wonderful group of believers in Germany that I had seen every year for years up through 2019, and now I don't know if I'll ever get to see them again. So I love teaching church history. That has helped me a great deal because there have been dark, dark times in the history of this world. And I've mentioned it many times before, 1347 to 1351. You live in Europe, and in some cities, 75% of the people that were there in 1346 are not there in 1351. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what it was like to walk by those houses? And little houses and big houses, it didn't care.
Yeah.
It didn't care. And man, do you think you thought about your mortality?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But pretty easy to have been reading Revelation and seeing every single plague all at once being fulfilled right in front of your eyes. And it would have been easy to create an eschatology at that time in my mind and tie things to Scripture that just simply weren't true. Because think of everything that's happened since the middle of the 14th century. Think of the missionaries. Think of the churches. Think of the impact that Christianity has had on the world as a whole, the improvements, the hospitals, the everything else that's happened. You couldn't see that coming. You have no way of knowing. And so the fact of looking at what Scripture taught about the promises of the Father to the Son and ask of me and I will give you the nations as your inheritance and all of these beautiful, beautiful things, I started reasoning from the big issues down to the smaller issues in the application. And part of the impetus for that was I've got grandkids. I've got a 5-year-old to an 11-year-old. And I look at this world, and if I did not have confidence that Christ can keep his people and he's going to accomplish his purposes, I don't know how I would be able to get up each morning. I can't protect them. I love them so much, I want to protect them. But I can't. And so that, if your eschatology is just something that's way out there and has no impact on, well, I like how Doug Wilson puts it, most Christians never, ever, ever think about their great-great-grandchildren. And if your eschatology makes you never think about your great-great-grandchildren, that's probably a bad sign.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking about my great-great-grandchildren. And I want to somehow communicate the beauty of the Mandelbrot fractal set to my great-great-grandchildren. So thank you very much for helping us to do that. But also helping us understand it. And they're going to need to understand worldview. They're going to need what you have done and what you continue to do in pointing out the presuppositional nature of how you do science. And the thing I love about you, Jason, is you do science. You're willing to look at all the data that's coming in. You can rejoice in Hubble. You can rejoice in Webb. You can rejoice in it's either X-ray or infrared satellite that just went offline about 6 months ago. And I just remember I've seen so many incredible images from that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at something like that, and I know a bunch of the people that worked on that had no earthly idea of who their creator is or anything else. They're examples of common grace, but they couldn't have done what they did without the universe functioning in an orderly fashion.
Right.
They could never have... remember when we, about 6-7 years ago, we fired basically something about the size of a refrigerator at a passing comet or asteroid. I forget which one it was. So we fired that thing off, and then the unit stayed behind and then recorded the impact.
Mm-hmm.
And then used various means of going, okay, this will help us understand what this thing's made of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can't hit that sucker if math doesn't work.
That's right.
Because when you think about it, what was the line? Oh, please don't tell me you have this memorized. What was the line that the new Scotty used in the new Star Trek movie when they had to beam? They had to beam onto the Enterprise at warp, remember?
It never occurred to me that space was the thing that was moving.
Right. But he said, it's sort of like trying to shoot an arrow arrow through something while you're riding
horseback.
Riding a horse.
Yeah.
That Scott, I have to admit, I liked that Scotty.
Yeah,
he was good. He was really, really good. I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen Rich pop up and go, okay, stop. Quit with the nerdy stuff. But that kind of precision, that kind of precision requires orderliness and consistency.
Mm-hmm. You can do it without a belief in the biblical God, but you can't do it without the fact of the biblical God.
Right. Exactly. And so this question just hit me, and I'm going to throw it at you. I don't know if you can answer or not, but... Flat earthers. Could they come up with a way of explaining how to hit that asteroid?
Not a chance.
I cannot even be.
Not a chance. They don't have a fully self-consistent model. They do have a model, and I've looked at it.
Right.
And it makes a certain degree of sense, as all models do. But there's certain things that it can't explain, like sunsets. In the model that I've seen and have refuted, by the way, on the website.
Yes.
They have a... There's a particular projection of the Earth where you have the North Pole at the center, and then it goes out like that. And so it's a circular map of the Earth, and Antarctica forms a rim. That's a particular projection.
Okay.
Whenever you display spherical features on something flat, you have to distort it. That's one way of doing it. They take that to be the actual shape of the Earth. And then they say the sun moves around like that, and the moon, you know, and then the sun has kind of a cone-shaped beam. And under that beam, it's daylight. Okay. Well, what would be the minimum angle at which the sun could make with the Earth? How low in the sky could the sun possibly appear in that model? I did the math. I went through and calculated, and it turns out it's something like 8 suns above the horizon. If you've ever seen the sun lower than that, the Earth ain't flat. Which, of course, I have.
Well, yeah.
So if you've ever seen a sunset, that model's out. You can even measure the size of the Earth. But if you have a nice, like if you're by the ocean,
mm-hmm.
Say you're on the West Coast and you're watching the sunset. You're lying down. You're watching the sunset. You watch the last little glimmer. Bink. Stand up. You'll see a second sunset, and it'll take an additional 7 seconds due to the curvature of the Earth.
Really?
Yeah. And you can actually calculate the size of the Earth that way.
There are going to be people rushing out to the beach in California right now.
Or on the other side, you can do the sunrise. You got to stand first. So just a little blink at sunrise, and then lie down. You know, it takes 7 seconds difference for an average height person, and you can measure the circularity of the Earth that way. In fact, right now on the website, I'm doing a series of articles where I'm refuting a flat Earth advocate, and the guy's real nice. There's no doubt about that. But I think there's a lack of education in geometry and trigonometry. But I think students will say
they ain't the only one.
I know. But yeah. Students will say, when am I ever going to use this? This is when
this
you're going
to use this. Yeah.
And one of the experiments I hope to do. I don't think I'm going to get to do it though because of the smoke. Because I want to get the next article out on Friday. Because this flat earther claims that the horizon, no matter how high up you are, the horizon rises to eye level. I know that's not true. I've flown on planes, and you can see the horizon drops a little bit, but it's not a huge effect. And so I've got a level. At some point, I'm going to go up to Pikes Peak, put the level there, and so you know it's flat, you know, and then take a picture of that against the horizon, and by my calculation, the horizon should be 1.7 degrees below level based on the curvature of the Earth.
And from so, Pikes Peak.
From Pikes Peak, yeah.
In comparison to
the eastern plains.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you do west, it'll be a slightly different angle. But yeah, I mean, there are ways you can test that. Another way is during a lunar eclipse, the shadow that falls on the moon, always a circle,
no matter
what the orientation is. And that was one of the earliest evidences, by the way. Aristotle argued that demonstrated that the world was round. So people have known the world was round since Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that people need to know these things, and they're not taught them,
sadly, in most
education systems today.
No, not anymore. At least back in my day, you were taught to read. and read well enough that as long as you wanted to, you could improve yourself. I'm not sure how much of that is the case any longer. But so, Biblical Science Institute, that's not the only book you've written. We've talked about, we had to have you on and talked about your books on astronomy, and then you have a book that every time, you and I are both in a lot of the same groups on Facebook, presuppositional apologetics, stuff like that. Every time people ask for, hey, what introductory text can I buy to use at our church and stuff like that, your name comes up because Absolute Proof?
Ultimate Proof of Creation.
Ultimate Proof of Creation, which I think on a marketing level I'd go, I'm not sure that was the best title.
Hmm.
And the reason I'd say that is that if anybody knows who you are, their assumption is it's about creationism, maybe fossils, something along those lines. People have to be told, no, this is actually about application of Christian worldview, presuppositional apologetics, the whole nine yards. And it's sort of like, oh, okay.
That's actually what I wanted. I want people to pick it up thinking, oh, I'm going to read about these new evidences, genetics and fossils. And I do mention some of those. But then when they pick it up, they're going to get something much better. They're going to get an actual proof rather than. So it was quite intentional.
Okay.
And it's apparently good marketing because it's my best-selling book.
Oh, good. Well, the weird, my best-selling book is The King James Only Controversy. So there you go. Different realms and different contexts there. But so you've written many books. Now you... Biblical Science Institute's been, what, 3 years, 4 years now?
4 years. We're entering our fifth year now.
Really?
Yep.
Time goes very, very quickly. We're both aging. I notice there's a little more gray in the hair.
Every conference I do, I get one more.
Yeah. Because I don't remember those earlier.
They were there. I've had it for a while.
Okay. All right. So, but, so Biblical Science Institute, you were with a number of different ministries in the past, but you wanted, was this sort of a, I want to be able to say everything I need to say the way I want to say it?
That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
Big part of it.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it that much, but that's why I do what I do.
You know, things like this. I mean, it'd be hard to sell this on somebody. I'm going to write it. It's going to have a lot of pretty pictures in it.
Right.
But it's going to demonstrate biblical creation. I'm not sure. But this is something God laid on my heart to do, and I wanted to do it.
Right.
And by the way, we haven't really talked about the book a whole lot, but that's one of the things that it does, is it doesn't just, it's not just pick pretty pictures. Now, kids will pick it up, they'll love the pictures.
Oh, of course, the color is
beautiful. And I thought about, you know, making calendars with those things, which I can do. And if you get the book, you get the program, you can do that too. So there you go.
Right.
But one of the things I illustrate in this book is that only the Christian worldview can explain the images that are in this book. One of the questions that came up on Facebook, on my Facebook feed, who did the cover? And I'm like, I got to be honest with you, God did the cover. No human being created that shape. Now, I picked the colors, right, but the shape, that's God's.
You seem to like blue.
I do like blue.
Yes, I could tell.
For sure.
And a few other things I won't mention.
But there's a lot, that's true. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's a few, I mean, I picked out, there's a bunch of different, and it's very colorful, so I think that, but the main thing here to recognize is, although I picked the color scheme, the colors are assigned based on the value of an equation, and that's built into math by the creator of math. So this literally is artwork of God. There's no other explanation.
So all right, let's be a secularist here for the last few minutes. A secularist looks at that and just goes, it just is. I mean, okay. So there's a equation, and when you plot it, it does this, and as you zoom in on it, it keeps reduplicating itself. But it just is.
Sound and fury signifying nothing.
Sound and fury signifying nothing. That's all they can say.
Yeah, and I discuss that in the book. I say, okay, how would the secularist try and explain this? Mm-hmm. How would he make sense of it? Because in the secular view, what is math? See, I as a Christian can answer that question. I can say math is the study of the relationship between numbers, and somebody says, what are numbers? And I'm going to say numbers are concepts of quantity as determined by God. So in my worldview, math and numbers exist in the mind of God. They're his creations in the sense that he's responsible for them. In the secular view, what are numbers? Concepts of quantity.
Which is why India can build spaceships and we can build spaceships and land on the moon.
Yep.
It doesn't matter if they have, if it's different over there, there's a consistency that exists everywhere.
They can have a different culture, different language, but they use the same map because they have to appeal to the same mind, the mind of God, in order to be able to do that. Again, they can deny that God, but they can't escape the reality that God, this is God's universe. That's one of the other things the book goes into detail on, is how is it, why is it that math applies to the physical universe? Most people have not given that a lot of thought. Most people say, that's silly. We learned about math from the physical universe. Not really. Imaginary numbers were not discovered by looking to the physical universe. Now, since we discovered those numbers, we found that there are situations where they do apply to the physical universe.
Right.
But they were not discovered that way. Many mathematical truths were discovered long before they were discovered to have any physical application to the physical universe. And some that still don't, we don't have any physical application.
Right.
You can go, you know, the universe, as far as we know, is four dimensions, three of space, one of time. In math, you can do any number of dimensions. You can do what's called Hilbert space, which has an infinite number of dimensions. And you can do math, and it's meaningful. And so, obviously, it's not just a reflection of nature. It goes deeper than that. How can the secularist explain that? Well, math, you know, something people invented. No, because then we could have invented it differently. And then India would have a different set of math than we would have, just as we have different civil laws than they have. That's a human invention. And so these are discussed, and I even brought up the physicist Eugene Wigner, brilliant Nobel Prize-winning PhD physicist, and he wrote a wonderful article back in the 70s, called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. It's one of my favorite articles.
Really?
And from his brilliant mind, but from a secular perspective, he comes to the conclusion he doesn't know. Basically, in the end of the article, he says the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics to the I forget the exact quote, but to the application of the physical universe is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. That's his conclusion.
Sounds like Grace.
Yeah.
Sounds a lot like Grace.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, that's great stuff. Well, so people can go to biblicalscienceinstitute.com.
Yeah.
Okay. So you even had to think about it for a second.
I think about the second. Well, if you go to the others, it'll forward you there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And go to the store, and they can get all the books, including Fractals. Now, I don't think you charge nearly enough for it, because it's full color, and you know that means you have to have heavy paper and everything else. But they can get their copy there. Is it eventually going to be available on Amazon, places like that?
Yeah, I think it will be.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. New Leaf Selling and Answers and Genesis Selling. I will say, though, if you get it through our website, we include the CD with it as well.
Oh, okay, right.
So, and the CD has all kinds of fractal plotting software on it, including the one I wrote that does the fractals in this book. And it's also got, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it yet. But it also has electronic versions of all the images in the book.
Oh, that's neat.
And the cool thing is, if you use the software that I wrote and you take the image and drop it in the software, you can continue to zoom in on it. So, yeah. So that and any new image you save, too, it stores the coordinates in the image and the equation and everything you need to know. So you just drop it back in the program and you can continue to zoom in.
The first program I had was called Sterling. And then I found something called Ultra Fractal, which has been supported all these years by the same guy, which I guess I can understand that. And then on my iPhone, I don't know if you've seen someone produce a program called Frax.
I've got the free version of it.
Yeah. And you can, when you create something, you can buy credits and upload it to their cloud and get massively high-resolution downloads from whatever you've come up with. And especially if you're just really into the what it looks like stuff, that Frax program is
it's pretty
impressive. I mean, you can change light directions and some of the my favorite ones. Ultra Fractal was more manual, and so you were putting fractals on top of other fractals and then doing interfacing between them, and that would create some really fascinating effects and stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, the geek factor of this particular program could be a new record. It could, between Fractals and Star Trek, I think, wow. Well, what can I say? For the first program with a guest in the AO Mobile Command, we have set a new record for geekiness and I'm not sure what the difference between geekiness and nerdiness is, but I've never really understood the difference personally. Anyways, so biblicalscienceinstitute.com, fractals, the secret code of creation. Make sure to get it, and you will get it. Christmas is coming, and I think it'd be a great gift for students who going to university, for your pastor, whatever else. Am I doing a good enough job here?
Yeah, but you know, one thing I'd add, too, is because of the attractiveness of the book, my hope is that people will buy this, set it on their coffee table.
Right, coffee table.
Conversation starter, or loan it to your friend, because the gospel message is presented in here. And it's presented in a way that I believe is irrefutable. I can't make anybody convert. Only the Holy Spirit can do that. But I can give them an argument that they can't refute.
Yeah.
And it's in there.
There you go. There you go. So use it in those that way. So, again, if you're in the Colorado Springs area, tomorrow afternoon, 4 o'clock, Hope Chapel, Jason and I will be speaking. I am speaking twice. He's only speaking once. I misread. But he's speaking in between the two times that I'm speaking. I do know that much. And so we invite you to come along, and we'll get a chance to meet you then. And I really doubt that my talks will be anywhere near as geeky as this one. I can't see how they could no. So if that's an issue for you, but if that's what you really like, well, sorry, they're not going to be. I might be able to find some Star Trek analogy to use at some point, but we won't even bother trying. But Jason, thanks for coming out, and thank you for being the first guest in our mobile studio here. And so if I crash it next week, you may be the only guest in the mobile studio. We won't even talk about that. So thanks for being with us. Thanks for watching the program today. Thanks, Rich, for surviving back there. The looks we've been getting coming back have been fairly interesting. Even Summer, I'll have to find out what Summer and the kids think of all of this. But I don't care. It was fun. We'll see you next time. God bless.
Anybody else?
Yeah, no, we're here.